pleasure. What can I tell you? 770-563-3770-KMED. By the way, once again, to email Bill at BillMyersShow.com. And that's also where you'll find my personal webpage. All 3 hours of the program up every day. Well, the Heller case heard in front of the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday. Now, I didn't get a chance to watch it when it was first on C-SPAN, but me being the sexy, well-informed guy that I am, I was thinking about Linda. I was thinking, nope, there's nothing sexier than a guy sitting around watching C-SPAN. Yeah, I know, we're dweebs. But I ended up watching and listening to much of the oral arguments. I tuned in about 20 minutes into the replay of it, and I thought I would bring in our wonderful colleague up north here, Kevin Sterrett from the Oregon Firearms Federation, and it's OregonFirearms.org for their website. Of course, Kevin is author of Oregon Gun Laws, the complete book. And Kevin, welcome to the show. Good morning.
Thank you, Bill.
I'm going to give you my initial impression after having watched about an hour and 15 minutes of the proceedings that, dare I say it, the Supreme Court justices, a majority of the justices, sounded as if they were in favor of what the gun people are saying the Second Amendment is all about, which is that it is an individual right, not a collective state right. What would you say?
I think that as with any case of this magnitude, it's going to be dissected certainly until they come out with a decision in May or June, but maybe well beyond that. And so it's very difficult to draw conclusions this quickly. And, of course, people have. There's plenty of stories in the press. And most of the ones that I've read so far agree with your position. They seem to feel that the majority of the justices were leaning towards an individual rights interpretation. I just feel that it's very difficult to make a judgment about that because my experience sitting in courts here in Oregon, the appellate court, the Supreme Court, justices often ask questions that would give you the impression that they have one position or the other. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, that's not the conclusions they reach. So I'd be really hesitant, to try to make a prediction about this. Obviously, a lot of people are, and most of the predictions I've seen seem to be indicating that the Supreme Court is leaning towards the interpretation that we all have had, that the Second Amendment means what it says, that people have rights. And I don't know that we'll know anything until the decision comes out.
Yeah, we won't know until we know. Now, I agree with you. I would not go so far as to say I think that's how they're going to rule. But just a regular schlub who is not steeped in legal lore, such as myself, that was like at least the impression, and I'm sure that was why many of the reporters felt much the same way. Now, they brought up the Miller case a lot in the situation, which was an earlier case, 1930s?
The late 1930s.
What was the Miller case that they're using? Because one of the problems I have with the way our legal system is built up, Kevin, is that they seem to rely on case precedent. In other words, what did other court rulings say? It's like they never just look at everything, just the way it is by looking at the Constitution. You can have bad court decisions from 60 or 70 years ago that are still continuing to be built on today. So what did Miller do back then?
Well, it's a fascinating case, and one which I'm afraid may be repeated in this instance. And you're right. It was a case that they used as a precedent, which was very, very badly decided because the justices had very little information. It was a situation where a guy who was actually a moonshiner was caught in possession of a sawed-off shotgun, and they charged him with a violation of the National Firearms Act, which made sawed-off shotguns and machine guns heavily regulated items. Well, when they got to court, Miller, the defendant, had absconded. So there was no representation for Miller. So basically, the government side made their case, but there was no opposing arguments made. And the court found that Miller did not have the right. He was making a Second Amendment defense.
And since there was nobody fighting for Miller at that point, then the government ends up just winning, and they ended up beginning the government grab of power in this issue.
They ended up winning because the court came to the conclusion that the only firearms that are protected under the Second Amendment are those that are useful for militia activities, and the court came to the conclusion quite mistakenly that sawed-off shotguns had no militia value when, in fact, sawed-off shotguns were used extensively in the trenches in the First World War. So the argument was totally false. The court did not have any experts there testifying that would have come to a different conclusion. And in fact, Bill, I'm really concerned that the very same thing may have happened yesterday. That, you know, I was just reading an email alert from someone who I respect, a guy named Alan Corwin, who publishes gun law books. And he described the situation as having some of the greatest gun experts in the world all assembled in one place. And I thought quite the contrary. I got the impression that nobody who had an opportunity to be involved in the argument, I'm not talking about spectators, of course, but of the attorneys and the Solicitor General and the justices, I got the impression that none of those people knew much about firearms. And although knowledge of the law is important, I think a working knowledge of firearms would have been critical in this case, because a lot of things that were said that really made no sense. And I fear that this decision will be rendered on a real lack of information and knowledge, just as Miller was.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Kevin. By the way, if you just join me, I'm talking with Kevin Sterrett from the Oregon Firearms Federation. Happy to take your calls and comments on the Heller discussion yesterday that they argued before the Supreme Court. Now, the Heller case is also known as the D.C. gun ban. In Washington, D.C., no guns, period. Right? You just
well,
can't...
Well, that was, you know, that was a point that was argued. And in effect, it is no guns, period. Handguns are strictly outlawed. You're allowed to own a long gun, but you're not allowed to carry it, which means move it from room to room, or have it loaded or operable. It has to either be disassembled or it has to have a trigger lock. So while the D.C. government was making the case that they do not have a blanket ban, because they do allow shotguns and rifles, although they have to be totally useless, their claim was that the ban was not complete and therefore it was reasonable. And in fact, the attorney for Washington, D.C., Walter Dellinger, repeatedly mischaracterized the D.C. law and made it sound far less onerous than it is. I mean, if I tell you...
No, he out and out lied is what he did, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, he indicated that a person could, in fact, have a firearm for self-defense when clearly the D.C. law gives... There is no provision in D.C. law for owning or using a firearm for self-defense. And I think he made a kind of interesting mistake that was caught by the justices when he contradicted the idea that there were no self-defense guns in Washington by saying that rifles and shotguns were permitted. But the crux of his argument prior to that was that guns were only the only justification for having a firearm was for militia purposes. And then he was asked, basically, I mean, in a kind of a roundabout way, well, if that's the case, then why does D.C. even allow rifles and shotguns for self-defense if that's not justified?
Right.
And he really didn't have an answer for that. But it was a pretty, there were some remarkable statements made yesterday by both sides.
Yeah, and also some remarkable statements made by the person who was representing Heller. The lawyer there, at least from my view, it seemed to be bringing up that, well, we have no problem with regulating this. We have no problem with regulating that. It didn't seem to be a real strong Second Amendment stance.
No, it wasn't. It was quite the contrary. And I was really quite stunned by that, because I think that Alan Gura, the attorney representing Heller, in this case the person supposedly representing individual gun rights, made some comments that totally undermined his own case and the case for individual rights, and in fact undermined everything that organizations like ours believe that is the truth about gun rights. I mean, he came to the conclusion that people should be allowed to own pistols, but this should not be turned into a permission to own a machine gun, because a machine gun was not a reasonable thing for a person to have. Well, if you reach the conclusion, as Miller did, the Miller decision did, that firearms are protected which are useful for militia duty, well, what else would be protected except a machine gun? I mean, what is everybody walking around Iraq and Afghanistan with? And plus, there were comments made by both sides about mythological things like plastic guns, you know, things that were debunked years ago. And so it goes back to my previous point.
Of just not much knowledge of firearms precisely. Over in the Supreme Court. So let me bring up something else that I did not hear yesterday, and maybe you could tell me why I didn't hear it discussed here. The real intent of the Second Amendment, because the right seems to be morphing into, well, only a right to protect yourself, self-defense, a self-defense aspect of the Second Amendment, rather than be to what I always thought of the Second Amendment being to, and I know maybe people don't like to hear this, but technically to me, isn't the Second Amendment really a right to defend yourself against government power?
Well, actually, Bill, that was brought up, and it was brought
it
up
was?
In one. You might want to take a look. We have the whole transcript of the hearing on our website.
Yeah, I must have missed it.
Scalia brought that up in a way that I thought was actually so simple but so exact. When he was, you know, this argument has always been the anti-gun people always refer to the first part of the amendment, which discusses a well-regulated militia. And in the eyes of the anti-gun people, that means a heavily government-controlled army. The second part of the amendment talks about the right of the people to keep and bear arms, and that's the part of the amendment that pro-gun people typically refer to. And Scalia made the point that the two work perfectly together because the idea of the militia was, in fact, to protect us against tyrants, to protect us against out-of-control government, because you would have these – the militia was all of the people – you and I, everyone capable of serving. In those days, it was isolated to men, of course, but anyone capable of serving, and they were typically local groups. And Scalia's question said, well, he said that the way that militias were destroyed in the past was not by outlawing militias, but by taking away their guns. And since all of the people of the militia, a well-regulated militia, meaning a trained militia, could only be protected by the people having all the guns. And so the meaning of it really was, I mean, I think the meaning of it was dissected a million different ways, but Scalia's point was, I thought, exactly spot on.
Did anybody else bring up the aspect that every other right in the Bill of Rights is an individual right and a restriction on government power and authority, and yet why did all of a sudden they think the Bill of Rights was a right for the government?
Well, they brought it up in terms of the First Amendment, mm-hmm. where they said that the First Amendment is a person's right, but they were always discussing this in light of what restrictions would be admissible or permissible.
Yes.
And in the case of free speech, they said, yes, you have free speech, but it's limited by things like you can't libel somebody. You know, you can't slander someone. So you can say things, but you can't say things that are maliciously untrue in an effort to hurt another person. So much of the discussion was based on what would be a permissible right. And in fact, you know, as Dellinger, the attorney for Washington, D.C., was trying to make the point, the case, that a complete ban on handguns was reasonable, actually, I think it was John Roberts, who said, what is it that's reasonable about a complete ban? And then, of course, Dellinger's response was, well, it's reasonable because we allow rifles and shotguns. And then tried to make the point, as I commented earlier, that a rifle or shotgun could be used for home defense. And what kind of struck me and really troubled me was that nobody brought up the fact that rifles are horrible weapons for home defense, especially in crowded urban areas.
Sure.
That, in fact, handguns are probably the single best thing you can use for home defense because primarily, you know, you can make a case that a shotgun's a good weapon, but it still requires two hands. And if you have to move through your home and pick up a phone to call the police or grab a child or something, shotgun is a very, very dangerous weapon, not to mention it gets pretty heavy if you're holding someone at gunpoint waiting for the police to arrive. And those were points that, well, they may have been tangential. I think that they were key and they were completely missed because the people involved seemed to have an abysmal knowledge of firearms and what they were capable of.
Well, let's hope that some knowledge filters in during this decision process, Kevin, and we'll just have to see about that. June, we can expect a decision on this. This could be the big one.
It certainly could.
All right. And OregonFirearms.org, we'll link to that on KMED.com on my personal webpage. And Kevin also has the full text of the argument. It's like 110 pages. It's a big one.
Yeah, it's up there. If people want to see it, they can just go to our alerts page, and it's posted with the most recent alert.